It all started in the 80s and carried into the early 90s, from our teen years to college. The origins of the creative muse, when our eyes were opened to original voices in music, film, and literature.
It's where we began to understand the possibilities of artistic expression, from spoken word to hip-hop, from avant-garde to punk rock, books, films, and songs that inspired us.
I'm Kim Selby, and for as long as I can remember, I've been an avid consumer of film, music, and literature. I'll go to the ends of the earth to find those original gems that move and entertain me. I'm also the producer of this podcast.
And I am author T. Riley. My writing can be dark, surreal, off the wall, and out there. There's a list of visionaries from all sorts of disciplines I credit to helping me find my voice.
We're going to take a look backward at where it all began for the both of us, how it shaped our taste today,
and how we create.
So let's get started.
All right, so how's your week going?
Good. Nothing special or exciting. Did do some more record shopping.
Oh, yeah?
And good? Staying with the theme of only bringing up the records that are within the 80s, 90s time frame, I found a rare 12-inch of a Violent Femmes.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah, so excited about that. And I ended up buying three. Two were from more 70s rock. But it's good stuff.
Oh. What Violent Femmes?
I don't have it in front of me. So I would, it's the one with, if you know Violent Femmes well, it's the one, and here's a really graphic visual for you. It's a fairly large rat coming out of a toilet.
Okay. Lovely. I don't know them super well, but I know some of their music very well. So very well, meaning I would play their one cassette over and over again.
Well, funny, it's a 12 inch. I only have a couple of 12 inches, but they're played on 33 speed.
Right.
Whereas the 45, which is typically your smaller 45 records.
Right.
This one apparently is played on 45, and if you know Violent Femmes, you know that the lead singer has a fairly, not ridiculously high voice, but he's got a fairly high voice, and he just didn't when I first started playing it, and I'm like, this is not how I remember the Violent Femmes. It took a couple minutes to realize because it wasn't ridiculously slow, but I had to play this 12 inch on 45.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Oh boy. Well, that's good. Well, it's interesting you bring up music because I thought today what we might talk about is music. A couple weeks ago, two episodes ago, we talked about the one book that stood out to us growing up, served as a gateway. We've been talking about gateways into creativity and where some of our influences came from. And I thought maybe today we could talk about the music that influenced us. And, you know, I know, you know, we've talked before how we both seem to have pretty eclectic taste in music. But, you know, back when we were growing up, I'm sure there were some ones that really stood out as influential. I just want to start by saying a quick anecdote, and then I'm going to turn it over to you. I was listening to an interview with Dave Grohl from the Foo Fighters. I think it was yesterday or Tuesday. Today's Thursday.
An amazing artist.
What?
I said he's an amazing artist. Love Dave Grohl.
He is. And he actually was talking about the fact that his mom wrote a book about, what was it called? I wrote it down. And I can't find it. From the stage, from the cradle to the stage. And it's an interview with the moms of famous musicians and talking about where they, you know, kind of where they came from. And one of the things that he mentioned that she talks about in the book is all of the moms that she has spoken to, the theme a theme that came out was that the age where their sons, and I'm just going to say sons, I'm not sure if the full spectrum of who was interviewed, so hopefully there were some women in there, but the children, the ages between 11 and 14 seem to be so influential to them as they were growing up. And they found that if the music lessons and if they were really immersed in music for those 3 years, that's when it seemed to stick. And I thought that was really interesting.
Very relevant. We talk about, sure.
That's exactly why. And I thought, we were going to record this a couple days ago, and I'm kind of glad we didn't, because that really stuck with me, because that's when some of my music influences certainly began to resonate, and some of the bands that I was listening to back then and some of that music is some of the music that I still listen to now and consider it to be, you know, the most influential.
Yeah. And I agree, certainly. And just to carry that into college, just because you brought Dave Grohl up, when I was in college, the whole Seattle scene, other people want to call it grunge, but the whole Seattle scene was huge. And a lot of those bands were so influential to me. But and Dave Grohl, I love everything, almost everything he's ever done. Mm-hmm. Ironically, and we may lose half our listenership when I say this right now, I'm not a fan of Nirvana. I never was. As much as I love the Seattle scene, and I love a lot of the more obscure bands from Seattle, not even, you know, your Pearl Jams and et cetera. But I just never really liked Nirvana. And when Grohl started his first band, I had absolute zero interest in hearing until I heard him, and then heard all of his other side projects and just been, you know, in love with his work.
Yeah. He's a very interesting guy. I've liked him too. I was also very, you know, at one point at around 24, 25, was convinced that I was bound to, you know, what's the word? I was meant to move to Seattle. So I definitely, you know, loved that time in music too. I did like Nirvana, and you know, I think our parents or our parents' generation can always say that, you know, oh, when we heard President Kennedy was shot, I remember exactly where I was. Well, I remember exactly where I was the day that I heard Kurt Cobain had died. So
do I. Not to say that that wasn't impactful. I can do the same exact thing, even not being a fan of the band.
They were
an influence to that period.
Yeah. Well, this book looks really interesting, and I think I may pick it up at some point. Yeah, it's called From Cradle to Stage, Stories from the Mothers Who Rocked and Raised Rock Stars. So, Virginia Grohl. Have to check that out. I don't know. So, we already talked a little bit about, you know, we already kind of jumped into it. So, what do you, do you want to go first, or... Well, do you want me to go first?
Sure. This is, as you already alluded to, is an extremely difficult thing to do. I equate this to our conversation about the video store and trying to come up with one movie out of the video store that would have been pivotal. And the only way I could do this, and I kind of went through these lines of where I started with a genre of music and a band and how that evolved. And I'm going to go through that a little bit to just try to find one moment. It's not the only moment. I'm just giving you one moment that really was not just about liking a band or music or being inspired. But the whole point is to find the things that moved us to the next, in terms of finding that creative muse, finding that outlet to creating your own work, right? And so I was trying to find that, but I went all the way back to, we talked about this on one of our episodes when we talked about the boardwalks at the Jersey Shore, Seaside. to the very first album I had, which was Ozzy Osbourne. And
right. That you won, right? You won it on the Boardwalk.
And that led me to discovering heavy metal and then discovering thrash. And then ultimately, and I'll tie it back to our conversation about Seattle bands, ultimately brought me back to an artist I adore, Chris Cornell and Soundgarden, which was probably influenced by the earlier metal scenes. And I've talked a bunch about old school hip hop on these episodes. And I was inspired in the very beginning. There used to be, when I was like 11 or 12 years old, there is still this radio station, Power 99 out of Philly. And they used to, it was either every Friday night or Sunday night. I was trying to find this, but they had this DJ who's still around. Her name was Lady B, and Lady B was like the first like DJ in Philly. She started in New York, but the first DJ in Philly that was playing hip hop. And I would sit there with my boombox every night and waiting for that show to come on, waiting for her to announce the song, hit play and record, wait till when it's about to end so you can hit stop and miss the commercials. And I found that's where I discovered, you know, artists like Grandmaster Flash and Cool Herc, and that led me to groups that made me think more politically, like Public Enemy and Rage Against the Machine. And it also expanded because they were sampling stuff like old blues and jazz, and that eventually led me to find blues bands and traditional jazz groups, like one of my favorite, John Coltrane. And that all came from starting out with Lady B. And then I talked about before with hanging with the skaters and being introduced for the first time to suicidal tendencies. And that completely opened my eyes to that sort of counterculture type music and you know, the protest idea, but bringing it out of the 60s and more into the modern day back then that I could understand. And even, you know, hanging out with in high school with some of the new wavers and goths that introduced me to The Cure and Depeche Mode, and that carried on into college and ultimately found bands like Sonic Youth and Nine Inch Nails. All of that was all important. It was all amazing, but I got to come down to one band, right, to find that impact.
Well, in theory, but you know, we're pretty flexible here.
I'm gonna try to do it. So I've already given you those lines.
Yeah. Okay.
But at the same time, and I can't stress this enough, and people are probably getting tired of hearing it, but I'm going to say it one more time. Probably not one more time, just one more time on this episode. Nothing here is operating in a vacuum. Nothing. If I'm telling you that I'm listening to hip hop and I'm also hanging out with skaters and like all this is happening at the same exact time.
Right.
It's just like this mishmash of melting pot of just cluster stimuli coming at my brain all at once. So nothing is in isolation here. But I spent a lot of time, we mentioned this earlier in episodes of this is when I started to really find my juvenile delinquency. And I also have said that early on, I hung out with people that were older than me. And I continued that all through high school and into college. And when I was 13 or 14 years old, I started spending a lot of time with what they used to call the heads. You know, the jean jackets with the concert patches on it and the ripped up jeans and boots or the Converse sneakers. We used to go to this one parking lot and hang out, and this where the skateboards were and BMX bikes. There used to be this pathway to this woods, and on the weekends that's where the parties would be, because it was hard for the police to get back to you, and
right,
it was really clear and obvious where they were, and we had an easy out. And so, you know, I'm probably not the only teenager in the world that did that. So
yeah, no, we had the magic for us. So, right.
So yeah, so it's all there. And there was this guy that used to hang out there, and looking back at the age I am now, and if I saw him on the street, I mean, he would just be just some teenage kid. You know, he was kind of tall, lean, wiry chap. Always wore Rush t-shirts that were cut off at the sleeves. And a lot of times too small for him because he'd wash them, they'd shrink, he'd wear them anyway because it's the only thing he wore was Rush t-shirts.
Right.
And Rush to him was so much more than a band. And this guy was, the only way to describe it, he was almost like a prophet in the way that he spoke about Rush. And I can remember those days or those nights, sitting in that woods with those older kids. And he'd be up on this log and talking about how profound this band Rush was. And it was a band I had never heard of. And at the time I was starting to listen to a lot of the 70s rock, cause I was hanging out with these heads, and Led Zeppelin was a band that I really was really into. I really loved. And I had bought, you know, all their cassette tapes and so he piqued my curiosity, and there was one moment outside of the woods when I was hanging out over his house, and that was the moment that he put in Rush. And I had to laugh, like 3 months ago. I was sitting with the family and I was watching the Goldbergs with them because my daughter loves the Goldbergs.
Right.
And there is an actual episode of this guy. So one of the characters is this character who's really in the Rush and nobody understands why. And he puts him in a car and he hits the cassette tape in and he plays Tom Sawyer, and all of a sudden all their eyes get wide. And it's like they've seen God, you know,
right.
Because they've heard this song. And I'm not going to tell you it was that profound at the very beginning, but it was a sound I had never heard and it was amazing. But the reason why I picked that over everything else I just mentioned was how it connects back to what I do and love now. And I have been from an early age, a storyteller, and I'm an author now, and I'm attracted to anything that tells a story. And we can tell a story in many different ways, from visual arts to music. But that's what pulls Rush apart from some of the others. They are amazing musicians. Hands down, as progressive or prog rock goes, they are legends. They deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as they are. And interesting quirks about the band. The drummer wrote all their music and their lyrics, which is a very unique thing, because typically, even if someone else in the band is writing the music, it's the singer who typically writes the lyrics because the singer has to sing them.
Right.
But that's not how it was. And so the drummer wrote it all. And he wrote great music. He's an amazing drummer. But his lyrics were a lot more complex than you would typically hear in rock music.
Right.
And they were all stories. I mean, they were, if you listen to a Rush album, you're basically listening to a collection of short stories. And I like to make that, when I wrote my short story collection, I would describe that to people often when I was on social media or whatever, that I always looked at albums are very similar to short story collections. And each song is like a short story, and they are in a sense, but this is in a literal sense that the drummer and his name's Neil Peart, he wrote short stories and he wrote sci-fi and he wrote fantasy things. He wrote things that were dark and he wrote things that were politically motivated. And to sit there and listen to that entire album, to me in so many ways was like reading a book. And that is why I pick them, and they've been top of mind over the last year because of collecting vinyl. I've been able to find most of their albums, so I have it. But also not too long ago, the drummer of Rush died.
Yeah,
and last year, I think. They had finished their touring and everything not too long ago, but it was he had been suffering privately with cancer for a while, and he finally died. So, you know, whenever that happens, it at least for me, it tends to bring back the music and
definitely,
you know,
definitely
bring back the memories and bring back those connections, and it did make me think a lot about how finding Rush helped me, along with all these other things that we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about on these episodes, was one of those other steps that helped me find my voice.
Well, I think it's funny that Rush definitely seems to be one of those bands that high school age, and I don't want to generalize and say high school age guys were drawn to, because I had a group of guy friends in high school who, I mean, I adored isn't the word, worshipped is probably a better word, but that band meant so much to them. But it's interesting to hear you say that you were drawn to them because of the storytelling, because I think when you're younger, maybe you can't understand it quite that way. Like, you know, you love this band, you know, you listen to them all the time, you know all the words, you practice the drum solos, whatever, you do air guitar, whatever, but you don't know why. But maybe that's what it is, the storytelling aspect of their music was so strong that's what it was, that's what the link was.
Yeah, and I'll give you an example. There is a song on the album that most, if you know Rush, most people would know the album, and that's Moving Pictures. That's the album with Tom Sawyer on it. Mm-hmm. There is a song called Red, and I think I'm pronouncing this right, Red Barchetta.
Okay.
It's Red Barchetta, but I'm pretty sure it's Red Barchetta. It's a Italian car. I think it's any sports car that doesn't have a roof. I'm pretty sure, and how they what that means, but it is a short story, it's a song that's loosely based on a sci-fi short story, but Neil made it his own, sort of took it in a different direction. But it was, this takes place in the future, and it is a time when there are these really strict motor laws. So there are all of the traditional vehicles are not allowed on the road anymore. And there's this guy who goes to this farm that his uncle owns every weekend, because his uncle has this red Barchetta that he has preserved in his barn all these years, and he takes it out. And there's he ends up getting chased by what could be police, but there are these flying vehicles because it's future, and it's very much a car driving song, because it's got that momentum, and you just feel like you get behind the wheel and listen to it while you're driving. But it's a beautiful story, because he ends up going on this chase, and he's able to elude them, and he just comes back to just sit by the fire at night with his uncle and just tell stories. And it spoke to me then. It speaks to me more now, as over the years I learned more about the band. And the one thing about Neil is he was a guy who used to just disappear. He had motorcycles, and he used to often, when they weren't on tour, he would just go on a journey. And because he was the drummer sitting in the back, he wasn't a guy who was real noticeable. So he
right.
could go on a road trip and just be a guy on a road trip. And even when they were on tour, he often wouldn't be in the tour bus with them. He would be driving a different route on his bike to get there, just so he could see different things. So this idea of him being on the road and that freedom is something obviously that was really important to him. And then he wrote this song.
I didn't know that about him, but that's a really nice, it's some interesting biographical information to know about him. And it's almost like that sort of independent spirit. I'm part of a band, but I'm going to do my own thing. That's also, I think, what people attracted were. I think that's also why people were attracted to them, was because they kind of broke a mold. They weren't like any other band, and
definitely
they didn't make any apologies for it. And they just, I don't know. I think some people, I don't want to say make fun of Rush, but sometimes I feel like Rush is the butt of a joke for some strange reason. But maybe it's because they just did their own thing, and I don't know. I just
no. I would say in a genre that typically, I'm talking about older school, even though you could apply it to the more modern bands too. It's a genre that is connected to sex symbols and sex and groupies and sex, and they were kind of the nerds of the rock
show. Yeah, maybe that's what it is, where they weren't right. They weren't the typical rock band of the 80s with the big hair. Well, maybe they had big hair, but they were different, and they embraced being different. And
yeah, and so much about my writing often tends to center on at least one character, that whether it's the main character or not, that either is viewed as or self-identifies as an outcast.
Yeah, it's funny. While you were talking about Neil, I was looking up my favorite Rush song is Subdivisions. And I always, every time I hear that song, which was released in 1982, I just can almost bring myself back to high school listening to that song and thinking, they've really encapsulated what it's like to be a teenager in the 80s, or it just a teenager. Maybe it's just a teenager. Mm-hmm. And that song just really, really stuck with me. And talking about it again, I don't listen to them or don't hear them every day, but now you're making me want to go back and listen to them a little bit. And I used to have their albums too. I had so many albums collected over the years, and just, you know, from moving here and there over the years, just, I don't have them anymore. And I know, like, I can picture I had 2112. I had Signals. I know I had, you know, I did have I liked them a lot. Never saw them live, but I think Your Friend in the Woods is, you know, there's probably more than one of them out there.
Yeah, definitely. So what about you?
Yeah, I mean, I also, you know, had a hard time narrowing this down. And it's funny that you mentioned Power 99, because just seconds before you started talking about Power 99 and Lady B, I wrote down 93.3 WMMR and 94.1 WISP, mm-hmm. which are also, I'm sure you are aware, but they're also two very well-known radio stations out of Philadelphia. 94.1 WISP is no longer with us, but 93.3 WMMR is. And the same way you were influenced by Power 99, I think I was influenced by those two rock channels. And I guess hard rock would be the, now it's like, what would you call it now? Classics, which is so sad. But back then, I mean, they were playing Led Zeppelin. They were playing Rush. They were playing the rock bands, the Van Halens, the Journeys that really sunk in. And as a teenager, like growing up, when you start to be exposed to that music, it just, it really does open up something new. I mean, I grew up in a family who was not musical per se. Nobody played instruments, but had a good appreciation for music. You know, we had, my parents had a lot of records. I spent a lot of time listening to their albums. They listened to The Fifth Dimension, Neil Diamond, The Four Seasons, Carly Simon, even Fleetwood Mac a little bit, which Fleetwood Mac was probably kind of progressive for them. But, you know, we always had music on. But I think once I started listening to it on my own, whether it was in my bedroom at night or doing my homework, these rock bands just really started to stick with me. And I think that's the beginning of my love for live music, because the first concert I saw was AC/DC, and it was the Back in Black tour. Again, I'm completely aging myself, but I think I was 12 years old. I was in seventh grade. Wow. And, you know, they were they aren't the band, but they were a band that influenced me. But I think if we're going to talk about it in terms of storytelling and gatekeeping and creativity, the one band that I was introduced to on one of these radio stations was Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. And the one song was Another Brick in the Wall. And just hearing that song, We Don't Need No Education, just the words to that song, it was like nothing else I had ever heard before. And it was, like you said with Rush, you realized after hearing it over and over again, they were telling the story. And then you realize that The Wall, which is the album that, you know, Another Brick in the Wall comes from, was turned into a movie 3 years later. I think The Wall was released musically in 1979. Again, feeling very old. And then the movie The Wall was released in 1982. And I can remember, so I've mentioned on previous episodes that I grew up on the Pennsylvania side, and then the summer between seventh and eighth grade, we moved to, from the Philadelphia suburbs to the New Jersey suburbs. So I have very specific memories of listening to WMMR in my yellow bedroom outside of Philadelphia. And then I have very specific memories of being in the New Jersey house and begging my parents to please buy me, it must have been the cassette, it may have been the album, but to please buy me The Wall. The full album, because I had only heard, if you didn't own the album, you only knew the songs that were released on the radio. And I, for Easter one year, whether it was 1980 or whenever it was, that was my Easter present. And I went like crazy. It was like the best gift I ever got. And to be able to listen to that album, and now, you know, knowing a little bit more about Pink Floyd and knowing more about, you know, the way they write their music, and it is more of an opus, or, you know, you're meant to listen to the whole album, and the whole album is constructed very meticulously. And the song, you know, you're supposed to listen to the songs in the order that they present it. Once I understood that, or once I became exposed to that, it was like a switch was flipped where music didn't have to just be music. Music could also be a movie. Like, how do you make a movie out of music? But they did it. And I will say, I don't remember the first time I ever saw The Wall, but I will remember, I will tell you that I watched that movie over and over and over and over again in college. And it really opened my eyes to what creativity could be versus what you just assumed it to be.
Yeah. You mentioned the listening to the songs in order. And I guess another way to say that is a concept album.
Thank you. Yes.
And I I've always been attracted to as well. I mean, Pink Floyd is an amazing band, and I've back to the whole idea of storytelling. I've always been attracted to that idea of a concept album. And I was also thinking about, I've seen The Wall, obviously, too. It's been so many years. It's hard to even remember it. It's been so long, but I've definitely seen it. But there's also probably an album that is even even more, trying to look for the word, but even more compelling, I guess, to the of Pink Floyd listeners is Dark Side of the Moon.
Dark Side, right, of course.
And one of the I don't know, urban legends, whatever you want to call it, is this connection back to Wizard of Oz.
Right.
Have you ever heard that?
I have, yes. I've never done it, but I have heard it.
If you line up the movie The Wizard of Oz with the album Dark Side of the Moon, that it both lyrically and mood, it will perfectly line up with Wizard of Oz story, which I've never done before, but I have read about it, and it's an interesting concept.
Yeah, I mean, Dark Side, you definitely, you know, I guess I would say I did graduate at some point in high school to Dark Side. The idea that you could turn your art into more than just what it started out to be, and you can layer different things into it, it kind of blew my mind a little bit, that story doesn't just have to be on paper, or a song doesn't have to just be something you listen to. Like, you can turn your stuff into other stuff, if that makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
And I guess just, I am going to give a quick mention to my number two band for some of the same reasons, and that was U2.
Well, you're going to go into U2, and I'll just interrupt you for a second, but it's interesting to think about how you just described that, and again, find a different way of saying it is a visual medium in interpreting music. And so a 70s band moving into the 80s took an album at the tail end of the 70s and, you know, worked with a filmmaker to transform it into a movie, which was, you said 1982 was when The Wall came out?
Yeah.
So that is on the cusp of the music video.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Because that was, I mean, I know music videos still exist, but they have not near the impact on success or failure of music anymore. It's a compliment. It's not a do or die. And there was a point in the 80s where people really thought radio was going to just completely disappear. And I know there's a song that says it, but it was so powerful, that genre, that every band, it seemed, not only was writing their music, but needed to think visually as well, because ultimately that was going to end up on the screen.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting way to look at it. And now that I'm sort of putting these memories together, yeah, MTV came out right around the same time.
Around 1982, 83, sure.
Yeah, I was in eighth grade. It was my first year here in New Jersey, and I mean, that obviously changed everything.
I'm not giving Pink Floyd full credit for this. I'm just saying it's,
yeah, no. I'm just saying,
right? So
yeah, but it's interesting to think that what you just said about music coming out, having to think visually, because now you have this other thing that you had to do, which was the video.
But I didn't want to throw you off. But it is a good segue, because now you're going to go into an 80s band, which was, you said you were doing.
Yeah, and I kind of now almost don't even want to, because I think this, I feel like it's just going to be kind of hanging out there, because the way we were just kind of framing Pink Floyd and Rush, I don't know if U2 really fits into it, but they were influential to me because you're going to laugh. And again, you talk about, you know, sometimes Rush seems to be the butt of a joke. The Columbia House Record Club, which is clearly, you know, the butt of the joke, because that's what happened. You know, they sent you all these free records, and then all of a sudden you had to pay for them. And I'm surprised that hasn't come up on the Goldbergs. Maybe it will.
It actually is an episode on the Goldbergs.
Is it really? Oh my God, that's hilarious. Well, I was a very avid consumer of Columbia House. That was one of my most exciting, you know, days, when I used to get that thing in the mail, and I used to fill out that little, go through the catalog and fill out the little squares of the numbers. And then a couple of weeks later, your new albums would come. But That's
cassettes then, right? Or were you getting albums?
Oh no, I was getting albums.
Oh wow, okay.
Yeah. I'm older than you remember.
I didn't know that they were around for albums.
Oh yeah, they were. And I remember, you know, just collecting the albums, then all of a sudden like the bill came and I was like, oh, what do I do with this? we'll send you 20 albums for 10 cents and then all you have to do is, you know, buy four more, you know, at $40 an album. But that was a big part of how I started building a record collection was through Columbia House. And I mean, I had, you name it, I had it. And again, I wish I still had them. I don't. But U2 was in one of those mixes, and it was their Live at Red Rocks Under a Blood Red Sky album. And again, maybe the first band that they were from Ireland. They were new. They were young. And again, they had this album that, this was a concert album, and it was maybe, I may be wrong by saying it was maybe one of the first, but it was one of the first that I ever was exposed to. And that's just another album that I played over and over and over again. And their sound was different. Their storytelling was different. They were probably one of the, without knowing that I had probably already been exposed to political music, they were political. Uh-huh. And I was getting to that age, you know, getting a little bit older. And into college, I was very into U2. Joshua Tree came out, Rattle and Hum came out. That you really started to understand, oh, they're talking about something that's going on in the world. And for that reason, they were influential from a storytelling, from a concert, from a young upstart band. They filmed this concert and kind of guerrilla marketing at the time. People didn't know who they were. And now, you know, look where they are now. But
they are a band, just to tie it in since we did that segue. They are definitely a band that was a product of or benefited from
MTV.
From music videos, absolutely.
Absolutely. So it's interesting to go back and kind of piece those things back together. And you know, we've done this before where we are talking and figuring out things at the same time, but it really is. It goes back to what we were talking about. Dave Grohl's mom, that time between 11 and 14 or 15, where the stuff that sticks at that age is what sticks. And I think proved her point, because that's when it happened for me.
Yeah, same here.
Here comes the coda. A life-altering soundtrack on the way to the origins of the muse. But how about the origins of the music? What do U2, Radiohead, Rush, De La Soul, Live, and Boys to Men have in common? The awkward years, the teen angst. The answer? They all formed in high school. It's hard to believe that a few teens rehearsing in garages, basements, and school band rooms could become the legendary artists that make up this list. But somehow, they all battled through the insecurities and awkwardness of the teenage years to refine their craft and own the stage. U2 formed because of a paper ad pinned to a high school bulletin board, thanks to drummer and co-founder Larry Mullen. That simple act led to music that not only topped the charts globally, it delivered important social and political commentary. Tom York of Radiohead embraced his outcast persona by bringing together other student outcasts and directing Righteous Nonconformity to become a staple of the college alternative scene. Rush could be the biggest cult band in the world, but could never have been without two friends using music to escape their teen years of bullying. Eclectic lyrics and masterful wordplay, De La Soul set the stage for alternative hip-hop groups that followed for years to come, and it all began with three high school friends and a demo tape. The band Live, who made a name working the college scene until their fan base grew and they were selling out big stadiums, actually first hit the stage for a talent show in middle school. And the members of Boys to Men were in the right environment to cultivate their near-flawless vocal technique to become one of the most successful R&B groups of all time. They started harmonizing together at a performing arts high school. And one honorable mention here is the Go-Go's, the first all-woman band that wrote its own material and played its own instruments to top the Billboard album chart. Although they didn't attend high school together, founders Belinda Carlisle and Jane Wiedlin found each other in the punk scene of late 1970s Los Angeles. Both 20 at the time, they found kindred spirits in each other due to their shared teen angst throughout their teen and high school years.
Thanks for listening to Origins of the Muse. You can find out more about T at author-treilly.com. That's author-treilly.com. You can even read some of his work on his website. He's posted more than 75,000 words you can read for free. If you like what you hear on Origins of the Muse, you can hit the subscribe button, and you can always rate and review wherever you listen to your podcasts.